What can a fully impotent, chemically castrated survivor of two cancers and his postmenopausal partner possibly share about sex, intimacy, and relationships? Everything, they say, including a world of extraordinary emotional, sexual, and spiritual intimacy that most couples cannot even begin to imagine. Michael Russer and Jacqueline Lopez are co-authors of Return to Sex and Intimacy for Cancer Survivors and Their Partners. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I am delighted to welcome you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I am very pleased to say hello to Michael and Jacqueline. Hello, folks. How are you?
Hello, Pamela.
Oh, we're doing great, Pamela. Thank you. It's an honor to be on your program again.
Now, Michael, you heard me say a moment ago that you are the survivor of two cancers. What's going on with your health?
Well, it's my family, Pamela. It's my family. I lost five other members of my immediate family to various forms of cancer. My father died of liver cancer, my mother breast cancer, my oldest brother, some form of rare blood cancer, my oldest sister breast cancer, and then most recently another brother in malignant melanoma. I'm number six, and that wiped out half the family right there. I'm number six, and I'm the only one that has two forms of cancer. So I don't know if it's because we were raised in a meatpacking family. My dad had a meat processing plant back when we were younger, and we processed meats all the time. I don't know. I don't know if it's because it was upstate New York or there's something energetic going on, but it's very prevalent in my family, and it's a serious thing. And of the two cancers, the prostate cancer is the most serious for me because that's the one that can metastasize, and that's when you're in trouble. The chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, it's more bothersome. A lot of people have it, and it can be easily maintained over decades typically. It's just your white blood cells don't die as fast as they should. But the prostate cancer is pretty serious, and which leads to my chemical castration, which essentially removes testosterone from my system, which is considered the fuel for the prostate cancer. And so my condition has progressed since you and I have talked last.
It has progressed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But if you saw me today, you'd think I was the picture of health. And I feel like the picture of health. But it's there, you know, it's there. And I don't identify with it, but I know it's there.
And Jacqueline Lopez, you're in a relationship with someone who has cancer. That would scare a lot of people away.
Yes, it is scary, but it's also an adventure and an opportunity to enjoy life every day as if it was the last day. People make assumptions that life is going to be forever. I'm going to tell them that I love him the next month. I'm going to, you know, we're going to take that trip 2 weeks from now. You know, we live in a society living in the future, constantly aiming to the future, or, you know, having a conflict in a relationship for past events. In other words, our society lives in the past and in the future. And what we need is to live in the present moment, to appreciate every moment as if it was the last minute that you enjoy with your loved one.
You say early on in the book that you have both co-authored, which is entitled Return to Sex and Intimacy for Cancer Survivors and Their Partners, that the tragedy of cancer can also become the gateway to extraordinary levels of all forms of intimacy. So I'm going to ask this of both of you. How is that possible that cancer can become a gateway to intimacy?
Well, let me take a stab at that first, since I'm the one with the cancer. the cancer came with another gift, and that was complete clinical impotence. Now, a lot of the men listening just took a double take when I said that, but it truly has become a gift. And it related to our interview a few years ago when I was working on another book called Hardly Broken, which ended up being like a chapter to this book. Essentially, as Jacqueline said, the cancer itself becomes a gift. And when we're on the speaking platform, we tell this to the audience, you know, if you look at any challenge, within every challenge, Pamela, there is always a seed of a greater possibility of something even potentially transformational. And the cancer, the gift that cancer gave both of us, as Jacqueline was saying, is that we appreciate the moment and each other without thinking, well, someday I'll will. And it's not about the doing. It's about the being in the present moment. Now, that doesn't mean that you're zoning out from everything else. No, it's a deep state of awareness that we never would have discovered without the challenge of cancer and my impotence. So it's a deep state of awareness without judgment, expectations, or distractions. Imagine that kind of a space between two people. Very, very, very few people on this planet have experienced that. We experience it every day throughout the day, and that's an incredible gift. And in fact, we are now teaching people how to become present. We demonstrate it right up on stage. In 30 seconds, we can bring people to the sense of presence in 30 seconds, and they've never experienced it before. And often members of the audience burst into tears because they recognize what just happened. So that's the first gift. And the second gift, due primarily to my impotence, is that the way that men and women are wired, both culturally and genetically, is primarily for procreation purposes, which is great for making babies, but not necessarily so much for deep connecting intimacy on all levels, which is something that their hearts yearn for. And so the wiring can get in the way, especially as couples are together for longer periods of time, the gender differences, etc. Well, my wiring was short-circuited when I lost my ability to have an erection. And therefore, I was able to slow down and be much more present for Jacqueline in terms of how to please her in a way she wants to be pleased when we are sexually intimate. And that absolutely transformed, that has taken us places that we can't even, it literally has become ineffable, and it continues to get better. And we've been together for years now. And so those are the gifts that I see.
Yes, and exploration. The vibrancy of exploring something with your partner, not living on autopilot, not making love in a traditional way, exploring new ways. If this doesn't work, because our functioning in our body, look, I am 52 years old. There's certain things in my body doesn't work like it was. I was in my 20s and 30s. Therefore, I have to look and explore and discovery. And discover new ways to become intimate with my partner. So the discovery for me is fantastic because it's exciting. I mean, life should be exciting. I mean, people really don't appreciate life because they think they know everything. They figure things the way it used to be, or the way their mom taught them, or their sister taught, whatever. We live in a society where we make assumptions about how things work, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can explore new ways of being intimate with your partner if it doesn't work the way it used to work when you were in your 30s.
And we also live in a society where we tend to look at what's wrong, what's missing, mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. what's available mm-hmm. and what's present. You know, so, you know, it's easy to look at yourself and say, I am fill in the blank years old, but I used to be X, Y, and Z, and I want that back. If I can't have that, I can't have anything. And mm-hmm. and the two of you were saying that's absolutely not the case.
No. Oh, my God. No. Despite all our uncertainties, and we have plenty, Pamela, you know, certainly the health wise and other ways. We have a lot of uncertainty, but I would not trade my life right now for any other time or any other place or any other person. And it's because we truly are living right now, where before I felt like I was sleepwalking.
Survive.
And, yeah, just it's all about survival, you know. You get the job, do your thing, blah, blah, blah. You come home, you get frustrated, and you don't have life.
Yeah, you take a trip the same place where you used to go every summer.
Yeah.
You know, people just live on autopilot.
Yeah, they live on autopilot.
That's true.
And by definition, we chose not to. And one of the first things I had to let go of is defining myself as a man. How I define myself as a man, and in our culture, as you are well aware, thanks to our pharmaceutical and porn industries, men define themselves by the size and capability of their package, so to speak. And, you know, the only thing that could possibly be worse for my condition in that regard would be if somehow I stepped on a landmine and had it all blown off. I mean, it just doesn't get much worse than my condition. Yet I have never felt more like a man than I do now. And but the first thing I had to do is let go of that limiting belief that that's who I was as a man. So it starts, really, this all starts not about acquiring anything. And when we're up on stage, the first thing we tell them is, this is not about acquiring anything new. It's about letting go of those hidden chains that we all forge for ourselves that hold us back from expressing our complete and total humanity and spirit. And it's really about letting go and then entering into the abyss of the unknown, which is always the case in the moment. And that's why the moment scares people. And that's why today's 21st century version of Soma from Brave New World is George Orwell's Brave New World is distraction. And so we are addicted to distraction because it keeps us from the uncertainty of the moment, which is always there. But that's where the juice is. That's where
the vibrancy,
and the transformation happens, mm-hmm. is in the abyss of the moment where you cannot predict what happens or comes next. But that's where life happens.
Well, Michael, I mean, clearly you're saying that you no longer define yourself by a body part.
Exactly.
Which is...
That's what we teach other people, too. You know, women who have double mastectomies. That is rough. That is hard.
And they're
hard.
Getting younger and younger.
Yeah.
It's true.
Cancer affects a lot of people. And as I say, younger and younger all the time. And they need, a message of hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the first step, though? Because we clearly live in a world where both of the sexes are encouraged. I mean, turn on the television and within mm-hmm. 10 minutes, you've got evidence that your body part is what makes you real. Mm-hmm. So how do you, your body part is what makes you real. It's what makes you desirable. It's what makes you successful, fill in the blanks. So how do you begin the process of removing that clearly limiting perspective and opening yourself up to a broader awareness and a broader life? What's the first step?
Turn it off. Stop watching the media.
Yeah. Drop your Netflix membership.
Yeah, we dropped everything. And
detox news.
Yeah.
Don't listen to the news.
The news
that
is very negative, and everything, and the
and
thing
become more conscious.
Yeah, and then also, you know, be willing to explore. Here's when people make this shift. Pamela, and I'm sure you're very aware of this. It's all based on how much pain they're feeling. When the pain of their current circumstances, whether it's emotional pain or whatever, finally exceeds the perceived pain of exploring the unknown, they will make a shift. And it helps to eliminate the background noise and the background BS that is out there, you know, basically promulgating these false beliefs and limiting beliefs. Those are all chains. Those are all designed to keep us buying stuff, to keep us adding to ourselves, somehow thinking that if we keep adding to ourselves, we're going to be whole.
If I just get the newer model of that car, if I just have the bigger house, if I just go far in that trip that I always wanted to go.
You see these celebrities in Hollywood, they get all these facelifts and plastic surgery. They're trying to recapture something. You know, aging is part of life. It is part of the cycle. And so to let it go and then focus more on, you know, what is wonderful about right now. And this is, and how you, one defines themselves as a human being or a particular sex or sexuality is a choice. And the, and that's the first step, is realizing it is a choice. And that's where we see it has to start.
You say that the lack of empathy and the lack of resources available to cancer patients and their partners is huge. It's you describe it as being you say it's, in fact, I'm quoting you, a rampant lack of empathy and resources.
Yes.
So a couple of things. On the one hand, we're talking about really broadening how you think about yourself and taking away that narrowly focused definition of a body part as being who you are and what you are. And then we're talking about resources with respect to intimacy. So it sounds like we've also got to redefine what intimacy is and then make resources available, which I guess is what you and Jackie are really working hard to do.
That's right. And we do this in our writing and we get on the platform. But interestingly, that you would bring up the medical community, they recognize this is missing. And we've done the research. Jacqueline does all the research. I make the calls. And it's amazing how little there is out there. And one
we went to a symposium for cancer survivors, and there wasn't
a single discussion.
Nobody was talking about the consequences to
intimacy and relationships.
Yeah, relationships of the medication and treatment.
Yeah,
none.
It was so interesting. This was last February, and of course they had all the Harvard-educated academics and oncologists up on the panel. And when we approached them afterwards and asked them about this, we got the nice little pat on the head. Well, that's very nice, and yeah, you know, we have a program, which they really didn't, and all this, and not much of one. But it was interesting because when we walked out of the hotel to get, this was in the evening in San Diego, and we needed to get a bite to eat. As we go to the little store down at the in the lobby of the cafe, in the lobby of the hotel, two young women follow us out. They said
they overheard what we were talking.
They overheard what we were talking about, and they said,
"I want to hear more about
it. We want to hear more about what you guys do."
They were in their 30s.
No, I'd say even their 20s.
Yeah,
they were sisters. One had vulvarian cancer, which is, you know, very, and the other one had double mastectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they were young sisters, and they said, "No one talks to us about this." So what we're doing, we're starting in the front line. So in addition to the speaking that we do to the survivors and partners and symposiums and that sort of thing, we are just now putting together a 3-hour continuing education program for oncology and urologic nurses and nurse navigators about the intimacy conversation that absolutely needs to be happen at the point of intake of a new patient. And then we provide them with all the resources at no cost to anybody, including the medical community, to help them navigate their path through this as they go through the treatments. And so that's where we're starting.
Michael, you're saying at the point of intake.
Yes.
These conversations should happen.
When a patient comes in and realizes, oh, you have cancer, and they come in with their partner. Depending on the type of cancer,
reproductive cancer.
If it's your reproductive cancers are the most pernicious in this regard. Typically, the person with the cancer is thinking about are they going to be, if it's a reproductive cancer, male or female, they're thinking, am I still going to be a woman or man, right, after this?
Right.
And the partner's thinking, am I going to have a partner for much longer? So this is a really messed up place for them, and they're both anxious, and you know, you have existential issues and financial issues. Mm-hmm. You've got, and then and then on top of that, the majority of these cancers typically happen with people who are mature, and so if they've been together for a while, often for years or decades, there's a lot of wounding that's already happened within the relationship, and this could be the last straw that breaks the camel's back. And
the point is when they most need each other.
That's when they most need each other.
Interesting.
And yeah, and ironically, and we're not the only ones that this happened to. It can also be the threshold to extraordinary levels of emotional, sexual, and even spiritual intimacy that they've never experienced before, ever in their relationship. And if they are just open to it. But they first have to be reassured by the medical community that, because I can tell you some stories about what some of the people said to me, and it's like I wanted to punch somebody.
I tell you what, Michael and Jacqueline, hold it right there. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like you to share a couple of those stories that were told to you, because I'm sure that they will be instructive for our listeners. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Michael J. Russer and Jacqueline V. Lopez, co-authors of Return to Sex and Intimacy for Cancer Survivors and Their Partners. We'll return in a moment. Michael, why don't you share a couple of those horror stories with us?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd call them horror stories, more like I'm pissed off story.
Fair enough.
I remember after my surgery, it was clear from the blood work that I still had a PSA, which means they didn't get it all, which is not a good thing. It's called a failed surgery. And so if your PSA is not zero after that surgery, it's considered a failed surgery. That meant the cancer still in my body. Then they suggested I go through 7 weeks of daily, highly intense and focused radiation therapy in my groin area. And I was already experiencing signs of erectile dysfunction. So I remember going to the, showing up for the first treatments with the radiologist. And I says, is this going to help my ED or make it worse? And his response was, oh, we can fix anything. And that's the point I wanted to punch his face, because that is so typical. They think that, oh yeah, well, you know, we'll just put a little rubber bladder in there. We'll rip out the we'll cut into your penis, rip out the blood vessels that engorge when you get an erection. We'll put an air bubble in there. You just pump it up, man. You have it as long as you want. And you know, clearly they have not been in our position. And it's a very flippant response.
Lack of compassion.
Lack of compassion, yeah. And the other thing that we see in general is that the medical community, especially the oncology medical community, at least from our experience, and we hear this from others we speak to, is that they are so busy. Mm-hmm. I mean, my oncologist, he's constantly looking at his watch. He's looking at his pager. He's looking, and we see him for maybe 3 minutes, right. And that's it. And it's like,
and they probably block themselves out from the news, but they constantly have to deliver bad news to their patients. Therefore, they kind of create an armor around them, so it doesn't affect them. Otherwise, it will be a mess.
Yeah. Right.
But it's difficult to communicate when you're not present.
It's most of the, so far from our experience, most of the oncologists that we've run into, and granted, it's a limited number. Tend to be kind of shut down that way. They're very competent in what they do, but emotionally they tend to be very shut down. That's been our experience. I'm not saying that's for everybody. Now, there are exceptions, including the oncologist, Dr. Julie Taguchi, who signed the back of our, or who endorsed the back of the book. She was an enthusiastic supporter, but we found her to be an outlier. And where I think you're going to find the potential for more compassion and more like being present for the patient. That possibility, I think, exists more within the frontline staff, which is your oncology nurses and nurse navigators and physicians, assistants and social workers, who have more direct and involved contact with the cancer patient and the partner. And so that's where we're starting, and with them, because we think, and when we talked to them, they said, oh my God, yes, I want to learn more about this, because they're frustrated too. They're human beings. This is an uncomfortable topic in this country.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so we help them to make it not uncomfortable.
You know, Michael, I have to ask you this. I mean, clearly the name of your book and your conversation is about how to enjoy each other, how to actually create and engage in true intimacy with your partner. So explain how it is that in the midst of all of this, you say that it was important for you to heal the rage that you had towards your father. What does that have to do with this?
It had everything to do with it. 3 weeks before I met Jacqueline, I got involved with a group called the Mankind Project, which is an international nonprofit men's organization for the purpose of helping men embrace their full humanity, both masculine and feminine sides, and see that it's okay to feel things, it's okay to express things, and which in our culture especially, that's not encouraged. In fact, it's seen as a sign of weakness. I now see it as the sign of utmost courage. And
in other words, it's a healing process.
It's a healing process, and it's also an emergence process. It allows the full power of their humanity to come out, and for the good, instead of being repressed and seeing and causing a lot of the things we're seeing in the news today. And so, anyway, I, because of my upbringing, I did not like men at all. I never had male, real strong male friends, other than acquaintances. I only surrounded myself by women. I felt safe around women. I did not feel safe around men. And so, and this stemmed primarily from my,
right?
Yeah, it was more competitive. And then just the rage towards my father, because my father was a very, he was a superb man. He was a man of integrity. He stuck with his word, which is the very definition of integrity in my book. But what he stuck with were some very limiting beliefs about what, you know, being a man is and what even being a human being is. And as a result of that, I always felt very judged about not being a man. And
not
according
being
to
adequate.
His standard, yeah, not being adequate. I had tremendous rage, which I thought was already taken care of, you know, prior to him dying 25 years ago. But apparently it wasn't, because a friend of mine heard that, you know, I still have a problem with men. They said, well, you might want to go to this new warrior training adventure weekend. And so I was, okay. It was at that stage of my life. I was saying yes to everything. And I did. And by the end of the weekend, I could form bonds with men just as deeply as I do with women. And I continue to do that today. In fact, I'm very involved at the national level with the Mankind Project because of that. It's a powerful organization. The work they do is powerful, I should say. And it's so needed. And if I hadn't done that, Pamela, my heart would have been shut down to half the human species. That is not a firm foundation in which to build any kind of lasting relationship. I truly believe that if I hadn't done that, Jacqueline and I would not be together today.
I see. Talk about the skills that you say make up a well-lived life. You say there are five.
Oh boy! Don't ask us to remember all five.
I'll help you out.
Help me out.
Okay. Yeah. Be fully present, Jacqueline. What do you say? Yeah. What's that about?
Okay, being fully present is honoring that person in front of you, and I recommend couples who sometimes have conflict or there's some wrinkle in their relationship, because we do that all the time. I mean, Michael and I are just like every other couple. You know, we have difficulties and challenging times and joyful times and not so much. And what we do is we stand in front of each other and look at each other's eyes and absolutely dedicate that moment to see that person, not just look at them, but really see them for who they are, how immense this person is. Whatever label I created when I met him throughout our relationship, doesn't matter. I see this person who is gigantic in front of me, and I honor his presence by being there, just ignoring my monkey mind that's telling me I should have sent that email, you forgot to put this in your purse, you should have called your sister, all of these, you know, little agendas that I have for the day. Forget everything and just be present with that loved one and dedicate your full attention, because it's that important. If you don't do that with the most important person in your life, who would you do it for? I mean, what are you waiting for? Right. And how can you possibly expect to be treated in a way that you deserve if you don't treat him or her that way with full attention?
And Pamela, I would go as far to say that if anybody's going to pick up anything from this conversation or our book, it's learning how to be present. That itself will transform not only their relationship with their most intimate partner, but it'll transform the relationship with their kids, the people they meet in the checkout line. It'll transform
co-workers,
their relationship with coworkers, their boss, people they supervise, everything. It will transform their life if they learn how to become present. That one thing is that important.
Jacqueline, when you look at Michael, who do you see?
I see a person that have the most caring, the most kind. And when sometimes when we actually don't see that person, we're just looking at them, then you remember the bad time that you have with that person, you know, the
conflict,
exactly. When you're just thinking about, oh, he didn't respond the way I wanted, you know, you create this story in your mind. And when I really stand in front of him and I look in his eye, and I feel like I'm swimming, like as if I'm a dolphin and his eyes is the ocean, and I'm swimming in it, I just paying just that attention, that stillness. And I am in front of somebody that I utmost respect and admire, and I want to spend the rest of my life with.
Michael, what does it mean to be open-hearted?
Oh, that was so big for me, Pamela. I was shut down. Open-hearted is the willingness to remove all the armor that we put up in front of our hearts, thinking that we're going to protect our hearts, when I finally realized the heart needs no protection. The heart is never needy, never jealous, is not worried about existential survival, because from our context, which we clearly state in the book, we're not saying this is true. We just find it to be far more empowering than we are our ego, that voice in our head and all that. But heart open means removing that armor, which takes a lot of courage, because the armor was put there out of fear. So it means facing those fears that
cause us to avoid being hurt.
To avoid being hurt. But it's easier when you realize that what's being hurt, if you accept this context, is not you. It's not the essence of you. It's your ego, that false self, as we call it. So it becomes less personal. And that in and of itself, it became a very powerful tool for us to handle any conflict. So that we realize if there's a conflict, there's a charge, there's a little feeling like wounding, that was all being experienced from the standpoint of the ego. Mm-hmm. But our heart stands back and looks at, okay, there's the drama going on.
Yeah, we literally stand outside from that scene, and we see it as it happening. You know, the drama, the story that I create in my mind is really having a havoc with that moment. But if you stand outside from that and you observe it, I do this, like, look, you are thinking that he's going to behave this way, or he's going to tell you that way, or I don't like the way he say to me this, the situation, how being handled. if you stand outside from that drama moment, you can really see how it can really ruin your relationship, because these are the small wounds that it becomes bigger and bigger gaps in the relationship with your loved one.
Right. And so heart open is removing those barriers. And when you remove those barriers, when you remove all that armor, you're now available. It's much easier to form that state of presence where the true connection, heart-to-heart connection, happens. I mean, you can't have heart-to-heart connection if you got, 6 feet of armor like I did most of my life in front of the heart. You just can't do it. It's not possible. But so removing that armor.
Why don't we give her an example? Remember when we just came back from that, we went out dancing on Friday evening. Why don't you tell the story? I mean, let's give an example.
This is an interesting story that kind of give you an idea.
Okay.
So we go out dancing almost every Friday, and we love doing that. And then when we come back, we'll sit and talk, and not any kind of BS, but we usually get into some pretty interesting conversations. So I noticed Jacqueline kind of really looking at my face, and then suddenly she says, "My God, your face is so handsome." Of course, my chest, meaning my ego, is just pumping me up to something fierce. And then she said, "I wonder why I didn't notice it before." And then I thought, I asked my first stupid follow-up question. I said, "Well, what did you think of my face before, and what did you say?"
"Not so much."
Why did you just twist the knife while you got it in there?
Yeah. So he got up, and then I'm thinking, oh, what did I just do?
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Why don't you tell him, how do you handle that?
Oh, yeah. So what I did is that I was totally aware that my ego was just having a conniption fit with that. It was like somebody hit it with a baseball bat.
Yeah, it really hurt.
It hurt, yeah. But my, that sense of awareness, we call in our heart, but we really, it's that ineffable awareness impassively, I should say, is watching this whole drama. And within an hour, we were fine.
Yeah, and the lesson is that he can count on me being totally honest with him. I am
brutally.
Always say what I'm thinking. I never hide anything. Therefore, he trusts that when I say something, he's going to take it, the way that he trusts me, that I can be honest, that I can be transparent with him, and not watching my every word and not being able to say really what I'm thinking. This is especially important in the bedroom.
Yes.
Because what happens is women make assumptions about men's knowledge about how to be intimate.
Right.
And women think that men reads our mind, and they don't read our mind. We need to tell men how we want to be loved, how we want to be specifically. This is the way, honey, this is the way it worked for me. I love the way you do it. But how about if we try this other way, with kindness? But you have to be honest and transparent with your partner. Don't expect him to be the best lover if you don't tell them. Because you know what? We're not born with this knowledge. Nobody teaches us, and we are all different. It doesn't matter how many girlfriends your husband or your loved one had in their past life. It doesn't matter. You personally, you are different, unique, and you need to tell it. Spell out what works for you.
And I think that's one of the five steps to a life well lived. Is
yes.
Probably being authentic. And even if it means hurting the feelings, which means hurting the ego of your partner, but as long as it's done with the intent of being authentic and not intentionally hurtful, obviously, because then the egos start clashing.
Yes. In fact, you say be clear about what it is you want. And a lot of people, and I would say perhaps, although maybe less so today than yesterday, but perhaps more women than men have some difficulty with being clear about what they want. But now, even as I say that, certainly in terms of sexual issues, I don't know, maybe the sexes are relatively evenly matched in terms of their discomfort about saying what it is they want.
Oh, without question.
Well, yeah, women feel like, what he's going to think about me if I know this, whatever I know. Or, how we women are so self-aware that we shouldn't be you know, we're not supposed to know these things. You know what I mean? How
Absolutely.
Twisted our society is.
Yeah, yeah. If she knows these things, yeah. Wait a minute. How many times has she had?
Exactly.
Wait a minute,
folks. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back. Don't go away. Jacqueline and Michael, in terms of the stages of a committed relationship, which is something that you also talk about in Return to Sex and Intimacy, I'm curious about the final stage, which you define as maturation. And within that stage, you talk about rekindling, settling, and termination. What does that mean?
Yeah. Okay. So typically that cycle that you're talking about is what we call the almost inevitable.
And it's, maybe you should talk about Harry. And,
we talk about the Harry and Sally. Yeah. Harry met Sally. Almost inevitable relationship life cycle. And so when we're on stage, we talk about how Hollywood, you know, just prepares us poorly for any kind of long-term intimate relationship. And we talk about the movie Harry Met Sally. Well, the whole movie is about how they kind of dance around each other and finally figure out they're the ones, and the movie ends that they're, you know, implying that they're going to live happily ever after. Then we tell them the rest of the story. And so things start chipping away at that sense of mutual bliss. And eventually get to the point in many relationships, certainly not all, but many, where you either get into this point of stagnation and where fulfillment's actually quite low. They're maybe comfortable with each other. They may love each other dearly, but fulfillment, a sense of fulfillment is not there, or it's very low, and it could be emotional, sexual, whatever. And it typically leads that stagnation. If something is not done about it, it'll typically lead either to termination when they split. They decide they've just had enough. They want, you know, they want to risk the financial and emotional pain of splitting to achieve perhaps a better life. Unfortunately, though, most couples that do that end up looking for another partner to fix what they thought was wrong in their previous relationship,
and they
not realizing
the same mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why the divorce statistics for second and third marriages are much higher than the first marriage. And so they have to first, if they're going to do that, they have to go and do their own work before, which is what I did. I didn't even bother dating after I ended a 26-year marriage. I needed to do my work. And
that's when you went to the Warrior Weekend.
Yeah, part of that was the New Warrior Weekend. And the other possibility, of course, is they just stay together. And so many couples are stuck there because they're afraid of the pain or cost of splitting, both financial as well as emotional.
And we have friends that we know clearly they're not.
Yes.
Fulfilled.
They're not
fulfilled, but you can just see it from miles away. Nothing is going on in that partnership.
Yeah.
And yet they have a cordial relationship. They seem to have fun. And I mean, they're good people, but you can see that there's no life there.
There's no spark. Yeah.
It's so sad.
Pardon me?
It's so sad.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Unbelievably sad and so unnecessary.
And people think that's life.
They think that's it. Well, everybody, they'll talk to, you know, their buddies or talk to their girlfriends and say, oh yeah, it's like that with everybody. And then when it becomes a self-fulfilling paradigm, and And that's not true. It's just a worldview that's so limiting. And then some people will seek out therapy, and sometimes that will rekindle the relationship, but rarely will they achieve the levels that they had at the, when the oxytocin was flowing freely during their honeymoon stage. And we like to say that that is incredible, unbelievably incredible as our honeymoon stage was, that actually represents the low point of our relationship. It has only gone up since then.
Yeah, because we have grown as a person. Each of us have done our homework, you know, becoming more and more conscious and more aware. So we have grown together, and our relationship has deepened.
Yes, yeah. And so, but that's because we put into practice the very things we wrote about and speak about. And we just didn't, oh, yeah, this sounds good. We didn't do that. It's like this was proven, and it works. And to our surprise, it worked. And so, yeah. Unfortunately, that's the three primary outcomes of most long-term relationships, and it's so unnecessary.
And what we notice, Pamela, is that people who are going through life crisis like cancer are more open to, you know, to explore what we're talking about. We see people coming to our events, you know, the cancer community coming, and then the women drag their husband to come to our event, and they're listening, and they see a spark. They see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's like, look, for how many years are we going to stay together? Why don't we try to have the best life yet for these few years? In other words, the men are more open to listen, because that's what we women love to talk, and we want to be heard. And what happened is men are more open to hear their women with whatever she wants to say. And usually women are more open to speak up for themselves, stand up for themselves. The things that we have kept for ourselves, because we don't want the man to leave us, because we have a children with us. We need that security. When we are in our 40s, 50s, or 60s, we don't give a damn. We're going to speak up. And usually it happens when we are going through a crisis in our life. We're more willing to speak our truth.
Yeah, more willing to risk breaking out of that comfort zone of misery. It's just, you know, it's a blanket of misery, but it's still a blanket, you know?
Indeed.
And, yeah.
I think it was you, Michael, who talked about the bliss of not living up to others' expectations.
Yeah. And the bliss of uncertainty, because when you're in the moment, the labels disappear. Because remember, the very definition of presence that we give is a deep state of awareness, devoid of judgment, expectations, and distractions. So expectations are those labels. Expectations are the things that other people or ourselves place on ourselves, and they're just thought forms. And so there's incredible bliss being free of those, realizing we're not shaped by those. We don't even have to be impacted by those. It's a choice. But that choice comes with a price, Pamela, because when you are truly present, there is no past, there's no future, there's just right now. And
it requires discipline.
It requires discipline, but it also requires facing the implicit uncertainty of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you see, we humans like to be certain about everything, because if you peel away all the layers of the onion, it goes back to survival. Am I going to be on some major predator's menu that night, or am I my head going to be on my enemy spike, right? Yeah. And so it really boils down to that. And so we don't like uncertainty. That's wired into us.
Or security.
Yeah, we want security. We don't like uncertainty. But you don't live fully that way. And that's what we discovered anyway. And to truly live completely means don't make these assumptions. Don't make these expectations. Don't allow the judgments to come in, or don't allow yourself to be distracted. And in that space, you have the ability to experience a level of connection with another human being that most people probably have never experienced before. And it's both heady and scary. It's heady because you are feeling things. You are experiencing things that you never even were even on your radar. But at the same time, you become aware, dimly at first, aware that there's, wait a minute, there's uncertainty here, mm-hmm. because I'm not just looking at this person, or I'm not just being with this person through labels. I'm allowing the full immensity of who they are to shine through, and I don't know what I'm going to end up seeing. I don't know what I'm going to end up experiencing. And I think so. It's
taking more like an adventure, yeah, as opposed to something scary.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I don't know how he's going to react or what he's going to say.
Right.
You know, instead of it being scared about those personality traits, celebrate.
Yes.
The unknown
and the differences. We celebrate our differences. To us, that's an adventure. The unknown's an adventure. Anything else is merely a guided tour.
You know, what's interesting, though, is as you talk about the connection that the two of you have been able to create between yourselves, it just sounds like a lot of work and a lot of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that there are some folks, whether they are feeling filled with an illness or completely illness free, who were saying, that is way too much energy. I don't want to expend it. I don't want to be that vulnerable. I don't want to do that much work.
Yeah,
well, then they're gonna live their life unfulfilled for the rest of their lives, and it's a choice that they make.
That's a choice they make, and it's not actually so much work in terms of, you know, you're, oh God, we're exhausted. Oh, you know, all that work we had today. No, it's not like that. It is being aware.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when people first start becoming truly aware, beyond that, if, that voice
you
in your head.
You integrate in your life, actually.
Yeah.
So you don't have to think about it. It becomes, you integrate this awareness in your life and becomes
part
of who you are.
Yeah. Now, the vulnerability, that's a good point, because being vulnerable, which is a charged word in our culture, as you well know, is usually perceived as being a weakness. We see it as one of the most courageous acts there are, because we define vulnerability, Pamela, as the willingness to feel everything. I mean, the highest highs to the lowest lows. And yet we live in a culture that essentially says,
conspire to keep us.
Yeah, we don't want you to feel bad.
Right.
For pain.
Yeah.
And
you can eat that ice cream.
So
you'll feel better. You can eat that candy bar. You can watch that Netflix you can't stand, but at least you don't have to think about anything.
Zone out. People go to the theater and they zone out for hours. Go to the mall. They zone out. You know, go shopping spree. They zone out.
Yeah. So the vulnerability is crucial. And because as you know, there's no one way valve for feelings. You either feel everything or you feel pretty much nothing. And, you know, before I met Jacqueline, I was on Zoloft for 7 years and I felt nothing. I didn't feel bad. Didn't feel good. Just felt nothing. And I wasn't loving. And so shortly after we met, I got off of it. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry was all too anxious to get me on that. And I asked the psychiatrist at the time, he said, you know, I do, just to let you know, I get paid by this company to speak about it. And that should have been my warning right there.
Yeah.
But it's so unfortunate. So yes. So typically, again, we go back to, for most people, they have to get to a point where the misery of their certainty exceeds the perceived misery of uncertainty, where everything happens, where the magic happens. And when you're dealing with people who are facing a life-threatening
mm-hmm.
illness,
they
such
usually
as cancer,
are open.
They're more open to that possibility. It is very difficult to have this conversation with people who have no major challenges in their
mm-hmm.
life
mm-hmm.
because they are comfortable in their misery. And there's that comfort blanket
again.
And
they become part of who they are.
Yeah,
they're used to it.
Well, this is just what it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. You talk about holding master heart meetings. What's that?
Do you want to talk about that? Yeah.
Well, master heart meetings are a meeting that Michael and I do on, let's say, every other week or every month. It can be every other month. the point is we need to talk about things that bother us, about the minor things that bother about the other person, okay? So let's say I'm washing the dishes and I put all my dishes on the rack and I put the glasses on the counter, and Michael is looking at me like saying, why are you putting the glass on the counter? Because they're not going to dry. You know what I mean? The small potatoes that we when couples we live together. I was taught to do it this way and he was taught to do it this way, or he thinks this is the best way. So we talk about the minor annoyances in the relationship in those meetings. And it's a template. We have like a one sheet template where it's an organized meeting. And we say, look, I don't like when you throw your socks on the floor when you come back from work. Would you mind changing that behavior? And that person make a promise that they're going to change that behavior if they feel like this is something they can negotiate. So that's what the master heart meeting is about.
It's for the minor little irritations. And, the funny thing about that it's so funny because when we moved in together, Jacqueline would put these cups face down on a granite countertop. And I'm thinking, the engineer in me is saying, that's never going to dry. It's going to form bacteria in there. We're going to just die a horrible death. And
I had no idea. Sometimes we just don't know. We have done this behavior.
Right.
We have this behavior for a long time, and sometimes it's difficult to get rid of them. But if you know about them, so these meetings are for me to learn, what am I doing that bother him, that really get in his nerves? And we aspire to live in harmony. Therefore, we negotiate. We say, well, yeah, I can change that behavior.
Yeah. So so those are for the minor annoyances. For the big ones where we feel a major charge,
we
talk about it right then and there. Yeah. Right then and there, we talk about it.
Yeah.
And from the context of we are our heart, not our ego. The egos are having a conniption fit right now. We get it. So let's talk this through.
Yeah.
And that works very effectively.
To avoid the wounding.
You know, it's interesting that you are recommending that really nothing be ignored, that you pay attention to the entirety of the person and to the entirety of the relationship. Where can folks go to get more information about the work that you folks are doing?
Well, we've been told that anybody who's read our book, who's whether they have cancer or not, it says this is not just for people with cancer.
It's
it
true.
Really is for everybody.
It's
and
true.
So the first place would be our book, which is Return to Sex and Intimacy for Cancer Survivors and Their Partners. Or just remember, Return to Sex and Intimacy. That's the only one that has that title on Amazon, both in print and Kindle. And then also
the website,
we have cancerintimacyhelp.com. Cancerintimacyhelp.com. And that has like
a calendar of presentations.
And then also that has that template for the Master Heart template that they can freely download. A lot of free stuff on there.
Q&A. We have a Q&A.
Yeah, we have a monthly Q&A that people can call in live second Tuesday of every month. They can ask us any question they want.
Wonderful.
So with a lot of free resources there, and this is our mission. This is not about getting
rich.
And
then Michael have over 100 articles. So if someone just Google his name, they'll be able to read all the articles he has written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Folks, thank you so much for joining us today and for the work that you're continuing to do.
Thank you.
Thank you
for the opportunity to have this talk with you. Thank you, Pamela.
We have a great time.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Or you can download the free Mind Talk app by going to the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So send me an email to Pamela@mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And I welcome any of your comments, your thoughts, your reactions or suggestions to any of the conversations that you are listening to here on Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And remember, always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.